everyone. Happy Monday, all. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. Tonight, I have a very special guest with me who was very patient when I had to reschedule her. However, she's just fantastically well-known, especially for her two completely different series. I'm so excited that Betty Webb is here with me tonight. Hang on just a second. So you're going to have a chance to talk with her, I promise. We'll be right with you. Everyone, to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm very happy that my guest is with me tonight, and she makes it so easy for the show to be interesting because she's so interesting. Betty Webb is an author who is with Poison Pen Press. She is a delight. Her hobbies not only include genealogy, and she's got some great funny stories to tell us about that, she is a zoo volunteer, she's a former journalist, she's a prize-winning mystery novelist, she has interviewed, are you ready for this, presidents, she's interviewed Nobel Prize winners. I cannot wait to have Betty tell me all about her life and her books. Please welcome Betty Webb to the studio. Betty, thank you for being with me on Authors on the Air. How are you, my friend?
Oh, listen, I'm great. And by the way, that music you opened with, that made me want to dance. The one thing I did not tell you about my bio is that while I was going to college, I helped work my way through as a go-go dancer.
Oh, my God, I love that. Well, here it is. My shout-out is to Robert Gregory Brown, who not only is a fabulous writer himself, but he is a musician and composer. He composed and plays that theme music for me. And he also has written an absolutely beautiful play for Broadway and scored the entire thing. Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
That's Robert Gregory Brown. Go and visit him on his website at robertgregorybrownwithane.com. Let's talk about you, Betty. First of all, I'm glad that you're here. We had a flash giveaway yesterday on my Facebook page, and I'm telling you, people went crazy because I said, I only have two books to give away. I'm not giving away my copy. And, you know, it was kind of like a temper tantrum because there weren't more Betty Webb books to give away. But you are very much in demand, so I wanted to tell you that. I hope the winners will call in and say hello to you. So I'm going to give that number. The call-in number for tonight is 347-633-9609. It's the same one, folks. You hear me say it all the time. 347-633-9609. Betty, you are so much of a writer. It's almost at a cellular level for you. Not only are you a prize-winning novelist, but you also were a journalist. You are a teacher. What is it that drew you to writing in the first place?
I don't know if I could even answer that. It's just that one day, without any forethought, I just started writing. My training was as a graphic designer. I worked in New York and in Los Angeles. But one day I just thought, you know, I think I want to write a book. But I couldn't figure out what to write until I went to a mystery bookstore and started looking at the mysteries and realized, that's it. I'll kill somebody. And I've been killing people ever since.
I love that explanation. It's just perfect. Had you been a reader up until that point, Betty?
Yeah, actually, that was how I was raised on a farm. In fact, we were 3 miles from the nearest town, and that town was only 1,900 people. So there wasn't a lot to do around the farm, but we did have the library on wheels come by once a week. And so I would clamber on board and get books, and then I'd read them. And then I'd be sitting in the dirt road out in front the next week with my red books and get some more books. So that's I started reading actually around 4 years old. And I've never been without two or three books going since then.
That's funny. I'm the same way. Are you a cross-genre reader? Do you like to read a lot of different things? Or do you, I would assume you did. You have so many interests that it just makes sense to me. What are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? Okay, let me turn around and go get a copy. Okay, here it is. I'm 3 chapters into Jonathan Kellerman's Heartbreak Hotel.
Oh, fabulous. How is it?
Yep. It's wonderful. His dialogue is great. That's one of the reasons I like to read Kellerman, because his dialogue, it's how people really speak. It's not formal. It's casual. It's like we talk to each other. And so his characters really come alive through the dialogue.
So let's talk about dialogue, since that sounds like a good thread to pull on right now.
Yeah.
Your Lena books are pretty heavy duty mysteries, but you have a social justice twist in them. But they're not preachy. They're not preachy at all. So let's talk about, how do you write dialogue for that character? How do you write for Lena Jones when go ahead.
No. Okay, what I'd like to say is that Lena writes herself. For me, when I dive into one of the Lena books and start writing, it's almost like I'm channeling somebody who lives. And I am not consciously aware of the creating process. It's like channeling somebody. That sounds superstitious and kind of woo-woo, but that's really what it's like. And Lena is kind of a hard-bitten gal. She's had a rough life, and that's how she talks. She's rough. And I don't mean in four-letter word variety of rough, but she lives out in the desert. She lives by herself. She's a private investigator. She lives above her office. And she doesn't have much of a social life other than interviewing suspects.
Well, that's a hell of a social life, isn't it, Betty?
It means she gets to spend most of her life with the dregs of society.
Well, I have to say that my absolute most favorite guy of all time, David Morrell, whom I affectionately refer to as the professor, had this to say about you. I've been a fan of Betty Webb's Desert Mysteries from the start. With some series, the quality ebbs over time, but Webb's latest, Desert Wind, shows increasing strength. Again, Webb uses her expert journalistic skills to explore a shocking topic that private investigator Lena Jones uncovers with masterly resolve. My jaw dropped as I realized the scope and significance of the mystery. Add awesome descriptions of the Southwest landscape along with powerful emotions, and you have a must-read. High praise indeed, but definitely worthy of it. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. And I love him for saying all that, too. He's a great writer himself. I've been reading David Morrell for years.
You and I both, as a matter of fact, he's one of my favorite people. I have him on as often as they'll allow me to drag him on the radio because he's wonderful. But let's talk more about you. Where did the Lena Jones character come from?
From a dream. I know that sounds crazy, but I dreamt her.
No, it doesn't.
I had started writing a mystery, and I had a dead body. I had a lot of blood, and it took place, the first mystery, Desert Noir, took place in Scottsdale, Arizona, at an art gallery. So I had killed this art gallery manager, but I had no idea who was going to solve the crime. I didn't know if it would be a police detective, a little old lady, because you know whoever your lead character is going to determine the tone of the book. And so I was kind of, with my first book, I was like every beginning writer. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And so I wrote the first chapter with the dead body, and then I went to bed because I got through writing. It was around 1 in the morning. Went to bed and thought, well, by this time tomorrow, maybe I'll have come up with my detective. And Lena Jones came to me in a dream. Her entire life, her background, her abuse as a child, and her future. It all came to me in one night in a dream.
Wow. It's so interesting that you say that because we're just talking about David Morrell, who says that he thinks it's a shame that adults don't daydream.
We often
talk about this. Yeah, he said it gives you such a better understanding of yourself, and
yes,
if you're a writer, a better understanding of human nature, therefore your characters. So
I find it
fascinating. You know, I say this every single night, and I swear to God I'm singing to the choir, but we are all 6 degrees of separation. You and David Morrell and his conversation and dreams, it's amazing to me. When you first started with Desert Noir, you did not reveal everything to us about Lena, though, and you still haven't revealed everything to us. You are still peeling back the layers of her inner self with us.
Yes.
Do you even know all of those layers, or are you discovering? I mean, obviously, you know a lot more than the reader does, but are you still discovering them, Betty?
Yes, and in Desert Vengeance, which is the new book, Ooh, I don't want to give this away, I won't give it away. But Lena enters a new period in her life. Let's put it that way, that I did not see coming. Now, I know how the series will end, kind of, but if it really does end. But I did not foresee this. And it's one of those things, so remember I told you, it was like I'm channeling Lena Jones. I'm not making her up. No. I'm not building her as a character. I'm channeling her. And she went out and did something that just made my eyes pop. But I loved it, I loved it, I loved it, and I kept it in, and I'm going to build on it for the next book, too.
I have to tell you that Desert Vengeance is not for the faint of heart. It's not.
Oh, no, no.
This is not your Agatha Christie book. So anyone who's read Gun Zoo and assumes that your thrillers are going to be a little bit tame is in for a big surprise. This is very dark stuff. This is really dark stuff. And by the way, so delicious. It is such a joy to read it. Let's talk about something that I found fascinating when I first started researching about you. You always talk about writing books with a social conscience. You know, I find that fascinating because I think that you know, as an individual, you have to, if you're going to talk the talk, you have to walk the walk. And you actually do that through your medium, which is writing crime fiction. Let's talk about that and how that came about. Tell me about it, please.
Well, when I was a journalist, I used to have to cover pretty much everything. And the one thing that the one article that I did not write is the article that has stayed with me. I'm not going to mention the name of the person because they were fairly well known. This person committed suicide, and he com- committed suicide by shooting himself in the head in the bathtub. I was sent out by my editor to interview the suicide victim's sister. I didn't like the idea of that because I happen, as a human being, to think it's pretty crass to say, oh, your brother
Absolutely.
Just killed himself. How do you feel about that?
How do you feel? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
How do you
yes.
feel? But I, you know, you do what the boss tells you. I knocked on the door of this, of where the suicide actually happened, hoping there was nobody there. But as it was, the sister opened the door, and I said, hi, I'm a reporter. And I thought, okay, now she's going to slam the door in my face, and that's it. I can go. She grabbed me by the arm and pulled me in. She said, I need somebody to talk to. And she took me into the bathroom. She was in the middle of cleaning up the mess and over 2 hours. She talked for almost 2 hours. And I had one hell of an article, and I didn't write it. I told my editor that I couldn't find her. But that stuck with me, the pain that that woman was going through. She went through just about every emotion you can imagine. She was happy sometimes when she would tell stories about her brother. She was angry when she talked about him killing himself. She was sad because she wouldn't have him to talk to. It made me understand to a certain extent how psychologists and psychiatrists must deal with people. And that, I think, I had that interview before I started writing my first mystery novel. And I think that woman, bless her heart, gave me a, like, human psychology 101 class that day.
Wow.
And that's why my books tend to be fairly deep, and they go deep into psychology. Plus, I'm married to a psychologist.
Well, there you go. I'm fascinated by that story. I used to work with victims of violent crime as an advocate.
Yeah.
So I understand, you know, the frailties and the tight wire that you walk on and all.
Yeah.
And there is a little bit of, we want to have vengeance on the ones who committed the atrocities on those
right.
around us. And
yes.
so you do that in your books, and I like that very much. I like the fact that, you know, you talk a lot about human rights abuses and all that. I'm fascinated by that, especially this book. It really slammed it home to me. This is, you know, just... I'm not giving anything away. You can go to the Amazon and read what this story is about, but we're not going to tell you the whole thing. But
no.
Suffice it to say, it is about a rape is how it starts.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It is fascinating though, very interesting to me. Your narrative and your background is very unique. Your descriptions of places put me in the spot, in the location itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that's because of my background.
Are you consciously aware of that?
Pardon?
Are you aware that you're doing that? Or is that just part of your process that you naturally just write like
that? No, I am aware
of
that. And that's because I think I was trained as a graphic designer. And so my background is in art. And I can't leave the house without noticing trees or grass or gravel. I'm very visual. So that's something that's very important to me. I want, especially with Lena. Lena lives in the desert, and she loves the desert. She even loves the desert when it's 120 degrees outside. And one of the reasons she loves the desert, and I talked about this in the first book, Desert Noir, is that she says that when people first come out here, when they first move here, everything looks beige. She says, but there are a million different colors of beige, and they're all here, and especially at twilight or at sunset. And I try to put that into my books. And if you'll notice, the Lena Jones books are always reddish brown. And sometimes actually a bright red.
I was going to ask you about that, too. It was very interesting, your covers, while not, I mean, it's a, I understand branding and all that. So, you know, I have enjoyed looking at the covers on your books. They're very distinct. And, but I want to just back up a minute and talk more about your eye for landscape and for background.
Yeah.
I assumed, and obviously incorrectly, that this was because of your journalism background, because journalists are trained to notice everything. And maybe your graphic artist background can accurately describe color, but I think your journalistic side also, it's a bonus because it's such you paint such a really good image in words.
Yeah.
You know, you use your words very well to paint the image. And then you soften it with your graphic artist hat.
Right.
So congratulations
on
that. Lovely.
The primary job of a journalist is to write who, what, where, when,
where,
and why.
When, and how.
And the where is where all of that sort of writing comes in. The beauty of the sunsets. In fact, when the sun sets here in Arizona, frequently the sand in the desert starts looking red and pink because it absorbs the color of the sunset. So, and I just cannot help but put that into the books.
Fabulous. It really is. When you begin to write a Lena series, do you prepare yourself in a different fashion to write than you do with Gun Zoo? Because Gun Zoo is a cozy mystery series. It's a little bit lighthearted, although there's some murder, but it's not graphic detail. It's not it's not a thriller. It is a cozy, and it's a totally different set of books. They're more lighthearted. You always have an animal on the cover. Do you prepare to write in different ways?
Not really, but once I am into the first chapter, I begin to change. My husband, who like I said, is a psychologist, says, he can always tell which I'm writing, a Gun Zoo book or a Lena Jones book. He says, when I'm writing a Lena Jones book, I tend to be very serious and cynical. But when I'm writing a Gun Zoo book, I'm pretty lighthearted and I'm joking all the time and I'm more animal conscious. Although Lena Jones loves animals too.
Right.
But I become something like my characters, I guess, short of going out and getting a gun and blasting away at the bad guys.
Right, which I'm sure you want to. You have been a long-time animal activist, a volunteer at quite a few zoos. I know you're well-known in the animal advocacy community and the zoos. Do you still volunteer, Betty?
Oh, here's the sad part of that. I got the idea for the Gun Zoo books while I was volunteering at the Phoenix Zoo, which is a beautiful zoo. And then after about the second Gun Zoo book, I realized I didn't have enough time to write two different series and show up at the zoo every day, which I'd been doing. So I don't get to the zoo as often as I used to, which is a sad, sad thing. But, you know, you do what you got to do.
That's right. Well, it's given you plenty of joy and plenty of inspiration for your books. And you know, maybe it's time to make room for someone else to go in and, you know, give you a little bit of a break there because you spent a better part of your life doing that. And kudos to you for that. And, you know, anyone who loves animals will absolutely, we're going to talk about Benzu in just a moment. I want to stick with Desert Vengeance and the Lena Jones book while we are. Tell me what your writing process looks like. What does your day look like when you're writing Lena?
Okay. I have the same schedule that I had while I was still working as a journalist. I started writing the Lena Jones books while I was still at the newspaper. And so the only way I could get them written was to get up at 4 in the morning and write until 8 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. And then I would get ready and go to work. And then, of course, once I got to work, I would write all day there. I thought that once I retired from the newspaper, I would be able to sleep in. No, I still get up at 4 in the morning and write. It's an ingrained habit. Yeah. It's like being an insomniac, only the insomnia kicks in at 4 in the morning every day. 7 days a week. I write 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Wow. Do you have a set a word count for yourself, or do you just write until you're finished? What is it like? Tell me what you do.
Okay, here's what I do, and this is absolutely insane. I outline every single chapter.
Four o'clock's insane. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I know. But I outline every single chapter, who's going to be in the chapter, where the scene takes place, who is in it, what they do. And I do that for the entire book. This is before I start actually writing the book. So let's say I've got 30 chapters in a book, I've probably got 30 pages of outline. And it's very, very detailed. And then I start writing the book. I do the actual writing. And usually around the second chapter, I forget the outline. And I don't do the outline at all. And I've done this, I've written 14 books now, 14 mysteries, and I still do the same stupid thing before I start a book. I outline it knowing I am going to not use the outline. And I have no idea why I do that, but I do.
But it works. It works for you. And, you writers are just kind of a crazy lot in that your superstitions. And so I bet if you tried not to do that, you would really something bad would it would be horrible. I don't know if you'd be able to write after that. So stay with it, please.
Yeah, if it works, if it's working, don't fix it.
Right. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right?
Yeah.
How funny is that? So, because I was surprised when you said you outline, because you said you get, you kind of, morph into your character.
Right.
And I was thinking, how does that happen? And then outline. Now, have you ever had a book turn out the way your outline anticipated? Or are they different each and every time? Or do you stick even close?
Okay. All right. For instance, let's take Desert out of the 14 books. Let's take Desert Noir. Desert Vengeance. That is the very first book where the killer turned out to be the person I wanted it to be. First time.
She's steady. You're so funny.
Like I say, once Lena gets the bit between her teeth, she's going to do what she's going to do regardless of what I want. But this time, and I think it's because Lena Jones and I believe the same thing when it comes to crimes against children.
Yeah, I would imagine that. I wanted to do a little change up right now and kind of have you turn your hat around, and let's talk about the Gun Zoo. And for those of you listening, that's G-U-N-N. Zoo. It is a fictitious zoo, but as Betty has stated, she was a big volunteer and has been for quite a few zoos. So you're not gonna have death and destruction the way you are in the Lena Jones books. Talk about Gun Zoo and how it got started, please?
Okay. I was working at the Phoenix Zoo. In fact, actually, the zoo itself in the Gun Zoo books is the Phoenix Zoo. I even have the same layout that the Phoenix Zoo has. I just picked the zoo up and moved it to California, then to the Monterey Bay area. But how I got the idea was, I think it was my second year volunteering at the Phoenix Zoo, and I was down at the anteater, giant anteater exhibit, watching the anteater play with her baby, her little pup, and they were chasing each other back and forth, and it was such fun to watch. But I knew from my work at the zoo that a giant anteater can kill you. They have 4-inch-long talons, which they use to tear open the fallen trees, rotting trees, and to get the termites. In fact, they're misnamed. They should be called the termite eaters instead of the anteaters. But
right.
I was watching these two anteaters play, and I was talking to a friend of mine, another volunteer, and I said, you know, these are such adorable animals. I wish somebody would write a book about them. And my friend turned to me and said, well, I thought you were a writer. And then I went, oh,
well,
yeah, you're right. And so I did not start writing The Anteater of Death, which is the first one in the series. I didn't start writing that right away because I was working on a Lena Jones book. But it was kind of, I guess, fermenting inside. And as soon as I finished the Lena Jones book, which I believe was Desert Cut, and sent that off to my publisher, I started outlining The Anteater of Death. And, of course, you know, I've told you how my outlines go.
Right.
But it was so different. The voice was... Now, the interesting thing is both of my series are told in the first person from the sleuths. And the sleuth in the Gun Zoo series is a zookeeper. And no, by the way, no animals are ever harmed in these books, but people die like flies. The zookeeper, her name is Theodora. Huh?
Right.
Yeah, her name is Theodora.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And she's kind of like a poor little rich girl, but she lives on a houseboat in Monterey Bay, and she works at the zoo, and she just keeps stumbling across dead bodies. And the dead bodies are usually connected in some way to the animal on the cover. For instance, we've got the anteater of death. We've got a
koala bear.
Koala of death.
Oh, the
very fierce animals, koala, very fierce. And the puffin of death, which was fun because I had to go to Iceland to look up puffins. That was fun.
Of course you did.
And right now I'm writing the otter of death. And so an otter is very much in the forefront in this book. And they're such fun to write. I will sit at the computer and I just giggle. I giggle while I write.
That's
and
fun.
That seems to go into the wordage that I use because if you'll notice the style is different in the Gun Zoo books.
Oh, it's absolutely different. It is so different. But here's the interesting thing now. And is it true that your first Gun Zoo book, The Anteater of Death, you were fascinated by an anteater named Jezebel? Is that right?
Jezebel, yeah. But I changed her name to
Ruth. I love that.
Because Jezebel in the Bible was a wicked, wicked woman. And I didn't want anybody to think that this lovely anteater was wicked.
So here's what I noticed on the covers of your books. Whoever does your book design does a great job. You have an actual picture of the animal, but it is superimposed over either a skeleton, like the head in the case of Lucy, or over another, you know, like a hand or something, the skeleton of a hand. Very, very creative. Your books are so well branded. They're really adorable.
I think that koala is the rib cage. So a lot of fun, a lot of fun to look at the covers on there. There's no mistaking which books are which. So I want everyone to know that. If you're looking for hardcore thriller, the desert books are the ones for you. If you're looking for cozies, you're going to see right away. If it has an animal on the front and it's not in red, that's the one for you. How much fun. What are you writing now, Betty?
The Otter of Death. It's one of the Gunzu books. And in this particular case, an otter is swimming around with a cell phone, and on the cell phone, it's obviously not it's freshly dropped, let's put it that way. There's a picture of someone being murdered. And the Teddy, Theodora, we call her Teddy in the book, manages to get the cell phone away from the otter. It's a sea otter, not a river otter. And sees and recognizes the man who's being murdered. And unfortunately, the killer is not shown in the picture. So she is trying to figure out who killed this guy and why. But as it turns out, we know this pretty soon going into the book, just about everybody hated him. Everybody hated him. And then the miracle is that he lived to be as old as he was. But I managed to get a few ecological things in there, especially in this. I do in all of the Gunzu books, but it especially in the Otter of Death. But let's see, for instance, now in the Koala of Death, there's a lot of Australian animals in there. Each of these books has a particular animal, but also a theme, as like the Puffin of Death, which was set in Iceland. You learn a lot about Iceland, such as most people confuse it with Greenland. But Iceland is the green country, and Greenland is the one that's mainly
rocks.
Is
the ice company.
And,
right.
Yep, right. And,
it's really funny,
so you
I know.
You learn a lot. I treat the descriptions of Iceland in The Puffin of Death pretty much in the same manner I treat the descriptions of the desert in the Lena Jones books. The places themselves actually become a character.
Yes. Yes, that's wonderful. Betty, I have to say, your reviews for all of your books are spectacular. Wow. But you are beloved for both the cozies and the thrillers. I know reviews are important. They are.
Yeah.
How often do you check your reviews?
All the time. I know. We writers are supposed to say, I pay no attention to my reviews. But I always read them. I always hate myself once I read them, but I read them. And sometimes I'm thrilled, and then other times I'm thinking of one particular reviewer, gives away too much. This reviewer likes my books, it's obvious, but, don't tell the reader what happens in the last chapter, please, don't.
Oh, geez, no spoiler alerts there, huh? Is it important to you to be reviewed by the PW and Booklist and all those? Do you think that's important? And do you think it's important to readers that you are?
I don't think it's as important to the reader, but it is important to the bookstores. And books are a business; they are a product.
Yes, they are.
And
sure.
The libraries, and by the way, I'd like to say this. Most people don't understand this, but one of the biggest market for books in the country are libraries. There's probably somebody is probably going to call up and tell me I'm wrong, but I think there are around 30,000 libraries in the United States. And if there's a librarian out there who knows, well, hey, give us a call. But the libraries cannot really order a book unless it has been reviewed by one of the majors, such as Kirkus, Publishers Weekly, New York Times,
right.
and that. So it's very, very important to sales, those reviews. And that's why I'm happy that my books get such good reviews in those.
Absolutely.
Yeah, although I do have to say probably one really, really bad review that I got, the reviewer pretty much called me a liar, was when I wrote Desert Wives, which is about polygamy in Arizona. And this was before anybody found out about what polygamy really is like. And
right.
knew anything about Warren Jeffs, who you may
mm-hmm.
or may not know, is now
huge,
serving
right.
25
huge
to life, and for
right.
child
has
rape.
One more has one more trial to go, I think, too, doesn't
yeah.
he? Still has
yeah.
one more trial to go, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
there's going to be more trials, both for rape and for financial fraud, because he was mixed up
right.
in his entire family was mixed up in welfare fraud. They were. I could go into the long
legal. Horrible
group
of people.
But there's
yeah.
no point
no.
in that. But,
horrible group of people. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it is rough. The
Betty,
the
you
women,
have you wear a third. Sir, I want to talk because we're running out of time, and I want to get this in because
okay.
it's really important. So excuse me for interrupting you.
Okay.
You wear a third cap besides writing thrillers and writing cozies. You also are a teacher.
Yeah.
You are a professor of creative writing. Will you
yeah.
talk a little bit about
Actually, I'm not a professor.
That,
that's a PhD, Ed, but I do
okay.
teach
you
creative
are
writing.
A,
yeah.
And you teach at?
There's something else. Also, I am the Arizona State Library has termed me a writer in residence, which means they send me around to the different libraries to teach creative writing. And one of the reasons I started doing this was I had this, in fact, I still do. We have a critique group that meets at, a writer's critique group that meets at my house every other week. And that group is, oh gosh, we're almost 25 years old now. And I noticed how much help some of these people coming into the group required. And so I just started talking a little bit in the group, and I realized, oh, my gosh, I should be teaching this. So I made a few calls, was lucky enough to get in touch with people who had actually read my books, and I taught what I know, not necessarily what you're going to get in books on creative writing. I teach what I know, and that's a kind of a personal thing, but it works because I help people, I help beginning writers lower the barrier between themselves as individuals and the characters they're trying to create. And sometimes there's a real mix up there.
I'm sure there is. Something interesting occurred to me when you said your critique group had been together for 25 years.
Yep.
I have mixed feelings about critique groups because I don't know
yeah.
that much about them. And I know there are authors who either strongly believe in them or don't. Is
yeah.
the efficacy of a critique group still valid and strong after 25 years, or is go right
well,
ahead.
Well, sometimes when I'm writing, I have a tendency to go too far, and so the other writers in the group, we're all published writers, by the way, and the
mm-hmm.
other writers will say, "Ooh, you're going over the top there, Betty," and so it's helpful. But there are now. See, I started the critique group while I was still a journalist, and this was before
uh-huh.
I actually started writing novels, and so we've been together for like I say, around 25 years, and in that time, we have seen each, none of us was published at that point, but now all of us are. And part of that is because we have learned how to spot problems in a manuscript, but at the same time, to find the really great parts of a manuscript and build on that. So I am for critique groups if they are run with compassion. And not every critique group is, unfortunately.
Is run with compassion, right.
Yeah.
So you have so many things going on. We haven't even touched the surface of your background and your love of genealogy and your fabulous stories about your families and all, because we're almost out of time, and that makes me crazy. So I want to extend an invitation for you to come back again. And I'd also like to extend the invitation for you to take the microphone and teach a class online. Would you do that on the air?
That sounds kind of cool. That sounds kind of cool. But, you know, one of the things that I do when I teach is I watch my students' eyes. And if their eyes are half shut, if their eyes are half shut, I know I'm losing them. So, but I probably could teach via radio, I guess. I've never tried it, but I'm always up to trying new things.
Well, why don't you, I'd love for you to invite a student or two to come on the show and give a class, you know, and maybe an introduction to creative writing. Would you do that?
Yeah, I think that would be fun.
I think it would be tons of fun. I think it would be too. Let's tell everyone where to find you on the web, though, first, so everyone knows how to get to you. Go ahead.
All right. It's Betty Webb, BETTYWEBB-mystery.com. So it's my name. It's all lowercase. It's my name with a dash, mystery.com. And all my
and
books
you're on
are on
Facebook,
there.
Too.
Yep.
You're on Facebook.
Gosh, I'm all over Facebook,
You are all over Facebook. I love the fact that you respond, too. You don't have someone filtering out your stuff, and so you do write back immediately. So, and I appreciate that. I really do. I appreciate an author who's not too big for his readers, you know, or her readers. So thank you very much for that. And you know that you are loved, because when we did the initial call out way back in October for female crime fiction writers, your name came up over and over and over again. And as a matter of fact, one of your Arizonian friends, Lala Corrieri, who's also a writer, just said, well, you can't go wrong with Betty Webb. Can't go wrong with Betty Webb. And I said, of course not. So there's a shout out to Lala and, you know, others out there. There are so many great writers out in Arizona. Amazing.
There are.
You really have some New Mexico, Arizona, all the Southwest has some fabulous writers. I'm going to call you again, and we're going to set up a time for you to come and do a creative writing podcast. I think that it would be so interesting. There are so many people out there who want to try their hand at writing or who are struggling. You know, it'd be nice to have a half-hour lecture and a half-hour Q&A. What do you think, Betty?
I think that would work well. There's two things that most beginning writers are not aware of. Number one is it's called the arc of action. They don't know anything about that. And then the other is depth of character. Too many beginning writers are using stereotypes rather than really digging deep.
And there are too many tropes with beginning writers too. So let's explore all those things. I'd love to set it up with you. I will give you a call when we're off the air one day and you're not in the midst of writing your book. And you and I will set a time and a date and set the whole thing up. You are a delight. I'm so happy that you came on with me tonight. Thank you so very much for being a part of Authors on the Air. And I'm looking forward to having you back again, Betty. Thank you.
Okay. I'd love to do it. This has been a blast.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you again. I hope good luck with the next book. I can't wait. It's the Otter of Death.
The Otter of Death.
The Otter of Death. And the new book
is Nothing Fiercer
Desert
Than
an
Otter.
Vengeance.
Selena Jones
Desert
book.
Vengeance now. Go to Amazon or one of your bookstores. And by the way, if you're in a library and you can't find Betty's books, tell the librarian to order the book for you. They will. They just have to have you fill out a piece of paper with the author's name and the title of the book, and they will order it for you. That's the way to help out authors. Get them into the library system. That's really
absolutely
important.
Absolutely.
You're a doll, Betty. Thank you so much for being with me tonight.
Okay, and thank you.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
And that's the first show for tonight. Stay tuned at 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Pacific. James Rollins, international best-selling mystery and thriller writer, will be with me. I'll talk to you then.